You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. We are just about to start. Thank you. Good afternoon once again. My name is Hendrina Doroba. I'm the education manager from the Africa Development Bank. I'm excited to be here, and I just want to say thank you so much for being part of this conversation. Our discussion this afternoon is on bridging the implementation gap in teachers' use of gender-sensitive pedagogy. That is a story very close to my heart. So I welcome you all. And to help me have this conversation, I've got renowned panelists with me here who are very knowledgeable about gender-sensitive pedagogy, will help us to unpack. So we are going to frame the conversation basically looking at what is this gender-sensitive pedagogy we are talking about. Do we have a shared understanding about that? And then we look at the teacher training and maybe look at, if time allows, look at policy implementation, and thereafter we'll open it up for discussion. So to help me have that conversation, I have with me Rebecca Nahawa and Charlotte. My apologies, I'm pronouncing in my local language. So these are the panelists that are going to help us have the conversation. Now, the discussion is about gender-sensitive pedagogy. Coming from an organization just a few months ago, the Forum for African Women Educationalists, where we were actually working around this topic. It's been a buzzword, I think, within the girls and women's education space. And it's an issue that has actually attracted a lot of attention, both in terms of conversation on what it is, and how that is influencing quality education, particularly among teachers. So we are going to have this conversation based on that level of background, but also being mindful that we have different understandings or appreciation of what this is. I'm very hopeful that the panel that I have before me will help us to unpack and help us to understand, and possibly based on the discussions and the study by Hawa, we'll be able then to actually reach to a shared understanding. So there's been a buzz, I would call it, around gender-sensitive pedagogy in the global girls' education. And like I said, in my previous job, we did some work around that. We actually developed a gender-responsive model, and we also published a teacher's handbook, which, in my view, has been very promising because of the attraction that has brought within that space and also the number of partners that are interested in that. But I also see an opportunity in my current role as the Education and Skills Manager within the African Development Bank, in as far as opportunities for policy dialogue and policy influence, and I hope we'll be able to maximize on that, particularly looking at it from post-secondary education, technical vocational education, and I think more challenging, I would say challenging, is within the higher institution of learning. And so I want to start by understanding how each of my panelists came into this work. And I'm saying that is the gender-sensitive pedagogy, is it a silver bullet solution for girls? What is your opinion? And why is it necessary when we are talking about the role of teachers in systemic change for girls? Why is this important? Why should we talk about girls? Why should we talk about teachers? And are we all talking about the same thing when we are talking about gender-sensitive pedagogy. Rebecca, would you like to start?
I don't know if I want to start. Wait, let me see here, my mic. Hello? Hi. Thank you so much, Hadrina. And the pressure's on now. She said we're all experts. And I have to say that after sitting through the mini panels today, I'm feeling actually quite humbled and not feeling like an expert whatsoever at the moment. So certainly those like Hawa and her fellow scholars who are here and doing their research have just really have done some amazing work. And I've learned a lot today. So my name is Rebecca Balmazaros. I'm Associate Vice President of Education at IREX. And really, I'm coming to this panel with a background of working with teachers, mostly secondary school teachers, in the work that we do in education. So broadly, that's kind of my framing. To the question of the silver bullet, I don't think that gender-sensitive pedagogy is a silver bullet. I think, however, it is an important part of a holistic approach. And I also think that we all are talking about, we don't all have the same framing when we say gender-sensitive pedagogy. And that's something I think even the four of us earlier were talking about that, and we said, gender-sensitive pedagogy. No, it's gender responsiveness. No, it's gender inclusive. So so what is it? And so I do think that we all come from different perspectives with that. However, I think that no matter which terminology we use, at the end of the day, the important piece is that when we're looking at the integral role of teachers in classrooms and the use of gender-sensitive and inclusive pedagogy, that when teachers include that in their classrooms, they're creating an inclusive environment for all students, girls, boys, students who have disabilities, et cetera. And that's really important. And so by using the gender-sensitive pedagogy, they're actually lifting up all students in the classroom. And that's an important, I think, an important framing.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. I'll start with this with two examples. Imagine me, Hawa, in a rural school in Uganda, where most of the girls in my neighborhood have dropped out of school. And, you know, I'm still going to school. But while I go, my teacher says, you know, you girl with a big boobs, you know, you're going to get married anyway, right? And oh, the teacher, I try to raise my hand, and the teacher's like, speak loudly, I'm not your husband. I'm not going to raise my hand ever again in that class. And secondly, I have no motivation to come back to class. After all, I'm going to get married. So the role of a teacher, even if you have a great curriculum that is gender sensitive and you have great policies, if a teacher is not inclusive and encouraging girls to participate, especially in these rural areas where girls, it's the norm for girls to drop out, definitely there's no future for me, and I'll not make it to be one of the 24 that go to university or college. So do I feel like it's a silver bullet? I don't feel like it's the only solution, but it's a super, super important one, especially if we are thinking about increasing enrollment, increasing quality. We can't achieve those two things without thinking about how we are involving both girls and teaching them really well and encouraging them.
Am I loud? Okay. I'm a bit nervous. but my name is Charlotte Yaraguha, and I work for Teach for Uganda as a co-founder and chief of operations. So I come into this work mainly because I'm very passionate about girls and also because of my story as a girl. When I was growing up in the 90s, my parents are actually high school dropouts. So my dad, who strongly believed in girl child education, really wanted all of us to have a great education. He moved from the rural area to come to the city so that we can really afford a quality and better education. And he worked tirelessly to make sure that we all succeed and achieve in school. And I remember my dad constantly saying, Charlotte, if other children can, you can too. You know, he says, there's nothing that other children can do that you cannot do. You just have to put your mind to it and you will be anything you want to be in the world. And he keeps saying, even up today, that my dad is the best hero I've ever had. And he's the best teacher I've ever had because he constantly reminded me of how valuable I was and how much I had to contribute towards, you know, the development of my country and even my own home. And so when I am asked, what is, you know, the value of teachers, you know, in this space of gender sensitive pedagogy, I think it's very fundamental that we understand the role of teachers in helping to shape the future of our girls, but also the boys, right? And so when we think about how do we recruit our teachers, how do we train them, right? What are the bars that, you know, the bars that we set for them that really ensure that only the quality teachers come into, you know, into the schools where our children spend most of their time? So those are questions that we all have to think about. And also, do we take time when we are training our teachers to think about how do we deconstruct their gender biases and, you know, and stereotypes that they come with, and how do we make them understand that all children are the same and they all have the potential to achieve, you know? And so if they don't have that mindset, it is really going to be very hard for them to embody and embrace this gender-sensitive pedagogy and use it in the classroom to be able to engage all learners and help all children achieve and fulfill their potential. So if you ask me, is gender-sensitive pedagogy the silver bullet? It isn't. It's a combination of factors. We need it, but we also have to look at other factors that hinder girls from achieving and succeeding in school, and we address them holistically so that we can help our children achieve. Thank you.
Thank you. You can tell everybody came in from a different perspective with a different understanding. But how I want to come back to you, maybe you can say a little bit more on what are the benefits and why is teachers' use of gender-sensitive pedagogy and how that could help the much-needed systemic change?
Yep. I talked about the benefits earlier in the morning, but just to say a few, gender-sensitive pedagogy is important. For example, if a teacher is teaching and encouraging all both boys and girls to participate, they are given chances to, you know, lead discussion groups, do teamwork. They both practice. And at the same time, eliminating biases where, you know, you say girls don't participate or it's only the boys that participate the most. During my study, I asked the teachers, you know, what they thought about their students, both boys and girls. And most of the comments I got were more positive on the boys' side. They're like, oh, the boys are confident. Of course, one of them said that you have to struggle with them to do their homework. But for the girls, you know, they are not confident. They don't speak up. They don't participate. And there was so much, I struggled to even summarize them. But this was an indicator of how teachers, even when they say they believe in quality of their students, without knowing, they were already biased in terms of what is happening in their classrooms and what they're saying about their students, both boys and girls. And talking about gender-sensitive pedagogy, they were like, oh, that is discriminative. It means we'll focus on only one gender, and that's bad. And that's not what it means. It means that you're giving me, as a girl and the same time as a boy, the same opportunities, helping me understand that if James can be good at mathematics, me as Charlotte, I can be great too. It's just as simple as that. And secondly, when we get to practice, we talk about developing 21st century skills. They are not going to happen by receiving notes. And both the teachers and the students say that the only methods they use the most is lecturing, giving notes. Students mark that highly, even the teachers. At least they all agreed on that one. So if students are not practicing in groups, you know, engaging in activities that force them to do critical thinking, that force them to speak up, that force them to solve problems, that in itself hinders their ability to develop critical skills. In my role at Educate, I engage in recruitment. And many times I have the HR team gets a really hard time getting an equal pool for both boys and girls. And many times we have a higher pool. And we always extend our recruitment until we can get an equal pool. Because if you don't have an equal pool, you're going to always end up having a biased recruitment. Because if you have like 20 girls and 70 boys, by nature of competition, that is already not equal. And when I would interview the girls, you find that, you know, they will underplay their achievements. They don't speak up. Boys, on the other hand, are very confident. They will express themselves. They will even state things they haven't done, which is good. But at the end of the day, that was my question. And in our program, we do train both boys and girls, and we've seen that girls can achieve a lot of results. In fact, in one of our evaluations, we found that girls were able to earn almost twice as boys in their businesses they started. So I started thinking about, okay, what is actually happening in other schools? How can I find out what is happening to inform what we've done and see how we can use that in those other schools where we are not operating? And for me, it was really mind-blowing, because when we talk about the benefits, teachers must understand the benefits. If they think it's discriminative, then we have a serious challenge. If they think it's focusing on one gender, we have an issue. If they think it's time wasting, we are never going to see gender-sensitive classrooms. And at the end of the day, if we're thinking about improving the quality of girls' education, it's going to be critical and important for teachers to understand what this is, especially when it comes to training, to understand, you know, that it is important and it has benefits, and most importantly, that it's not a lot of work.
Thank you. That's very interesting. But when I reflect on your findings, Hawa, you did mention something like it was surprising to you or to the study that you did that many of the teachers that were trained actually did not understand what gender-sensitive pedagogy is, or they didn't buy into it. What is it that we are not doing right? Why is that so? Is it because the kind of training we are giving, is it because of the way it has been done? Where is the issue?
What I discovered was the training itself, the trainers did not train the teachers practically. So they were being trained on how to use the methods theoretically. So they didn't know what else to do when they went back to the schools. Yes, I've learned all these things, but how does it actually apply in my context? Secondly, as much as we can talk about gender sensitiveness and being trained in the classrooms, teachers need practice. And also change is hard. It takes time. And the teachers that had been trained, one, when they go back to their schools, they're facing other teachers that haven't been trained. So they're having discussions, and the other teachers are telling them how they are wrong, how this can't work, how, you know, all the bad things about it. So if I'm a teacher who has gone through the training, I go back and I have my mind changed by my fellow teachers. But also when I go back and I don't implement these trainings and put them into practice, I forget. I don't know how to use them later when I need them. And the teachers themselves also had classroom challenges and administrative challenges. In instances where your administrator is not supportive, in fact, your administrator says, you know, you're supposed to share notes, you're supposed to give me the notes, and some teachers are paid per session that they teach. So my administrator is going to look at the notes that I've covered, not how I've taught. So at the end of the day, that's not something I'm going to do.
Rebecca, can I do you want to yes. that? Yeah. So it's interesting how some of the themes that you've just mentioned, I've heard from teachers and from other countries also. Recently, I had an opportunity to speak with some in-service teachers that had gone through gender-sensitive pedagogy training. And as part of that, what was interesting is that when I just asked them some basic questions like, what's it like in your classroom, they actually shared what I would consider to be stereotypes, like what you were just saying, which was, you know, boys have discipline issues and girls are the ones who really want to learn, even though they had gone through this pedagogical training already. And so for me, I think it was a great reminder that we all carry our own cultural lenses and biases to the conversation, and that we need to hit the pause button, I guess, and observe, reflect, and take action. So when you talk about concrete tools for the teachers, one of the things that we do when we talk to teachers about how to incorporate gender-sensitive pedagogy is we recommend that they first observe their own practices, or if they're observing the practices of maybe a peer teacher in another classroom, then reflect on that, you know, reflect on the gender friendliness of their classroom, and then take action. And so I think that those examples are great reminders about how all of us bring our own cultural lenses to the conversation, and sometimes we need to hit the pause button. And so with that, actually, I'm kind of curious just to see from the audience, how many of you are looking at these conversations just within your own organizations and thinking about how to model gender equity and inclusion? A few hands. Yeah. Okay. So I was just curious. I mean, it's definitely, I can tell you, it's a topic at IREX right now. It's something that we're reflecting on. But I think that through having those types of conversations, and for everyone to be reflective, that helps remind you as you're working with teachers, how everybody is coming at this from a different space.
Maybe to add something. One training is not enough. So if I come for a training and it's 2 hours or 1 hour, at the end of the day, that is not effective. So you can't say that I've been trained to implement. There are different levels. First, I need to just even have the knowledge. And that also will take its own time. Maybe, you know, continuous training and follow up, just pieces and doses. And then for a teacher in class, what I've seen is that once a teacher is taught something new, they're going to struggle with it at the beginning, even trying to even replicate the same thing that, you know, they have been taught. One of the things I came across was teachers were taken to a room to see how a teacher was practicing, you know, learner-centered methods. You know, they observed and they went back into their classes, and teachers had balls and they were sitting because in the class that they observed, the teacher who was teaching was sitting on a ball. But when they were asked, you know, why are you using this? Because, you know, it is interactive and that's why we are using it. So at the end of the day, even just applying something that has been learned takes time. And then maybe after at some point when they get to replicate exactly what they've learned, maybe they'll get to the next level where they now start coming up with new things and maybe go to a third level where now they can experiment with whatever they want and they're creative and doing other things. It is a process and takes time.
I want to add something. I'm a teacher by profession. So when we were being taught at university, we were told about these learner-centered methods of teaching. And actually, our professors recommended that they are the best methods we should, you know, that we could employ in our classrooms to ensure that all children are learning. However, the challenge is that when we go into the classrooms, we are grappled with large class sizes and these high expectations from the head teachers who are basically, who are focused on having teachers complete syllabuses and who want students to score A's, and they don't care about the process, but they really care about the end, you know? And so at the end of the day, you find that when you take time to really invest in engaging all learners, making sure that they are building the 21st century skills that are required of all citizens in this, you know, in this century, it's going to take time, and it means that you need to take time planning, you need to take time to develop materials that are really learner-centered and inclusive, and you're going to take time to think about how you're going to teach your lesson, how you're going to evaluate yourself and your learners, and at the end of the day, you need to think about, you know, whether you are tailoring, you know, whether you are meeting the needs of every individual child in your classroom. And so for a person to really do that, it means that, one, they're really passionate about what they want, and two, that they are not, you know, they're not being blocked by these expectations that the administrators put on them. And so they are able to, they allowed the space in the classroom to be able to innovate and become creative and ensure that there's really meaningful learning taking place. And so from my perspective, and also the perspective of other teachers out there, they, you know, some of them want to use these methods, but the administrators are the biggest hindrance. Others feel like it takes time, it's very time consuming, and at the end of the day, they don't see any reason why they should do it. And then thirdly, you find that others actually who really try to do it are discouraged by other teachers who think that, oh, why are you even wasting your time doing that? You know, there's always this saying that, oh, you know, you are really very, you know, fired up and you want to be very creative and innovative, but let's give you just 2 years. You will become like, you know, like us. And eventually, because they keep doing, you know, this great work and the rest of the people just take a back seat, they feel discouraged and they also, you know, go back to doing the routine of every daily teacher. So really, I think we need to think about how do we continuously support teachers, even, you know, post-training, to make sure that they get a lot of classroom observations, a lot of coaching continuously to make sure that they really hone these skills that will enable them to become effective teachers. Thank you.
Thank you. Certainly, like how I said this morning, there's a gap between the policy and implementation. And that means we really need to do something to make sure that we align both the policy and the practice on the ground. But we are talking about teachers who, from what we know already, are teachers who have very large classrooms, they have a heavy workload, and also most of them are not trained on gender-responsive pedagogy and many other contexts. So why What is keeping the teachers from being able to achieve the desired outcome in the gender-responsive pedagogy? I mean, you're talking of a teacher who is loaded and has a lot of work, and you're asking them to look at the gender-sensitive pedagogy. What is making them not do that? Rebecca, do you want to start?
I could start. Yeah. So one of the things that I've realized in my work with Teach for Uganda is that you find so many teachers who have left colleges like 10 years ago, but they've never received any refresher training. So the knowledge that they came with from the colleges is the same knowledge that they are still applying, which is really outdated, right? And so you find that in most cases, they are doing things because they are unaware, you know, of what they are doing. Sometimes they feel like, oh, this is the right thing, you know, to do. But when in actual sense, it isn't. But because they don't know that it isn't, so they continue doing the same thing. And then you also find that because of the lack of continuous professional development, the teachers, you know, tend to develop this fixed mindset, thinking that they know it all, you know. And so when a new person comes in and they are being told to do things differently, they are very resistant because they feel like, oh, I've taught like this for 10 years. Why should you come in and tell me to change the way I teach, you know? What is it that you're going to teach me in just 2 hours or just 5 days that will, you know, like transform my classroom? So really, the fact that the teachers do not have, you know, this growth mindset is also a big hindrance to using gender-sensitive pedagogy. And I think one of the things that we need to think about also as policymakers, as, you know, civil society, you know, people, we need to think about how do we engage, you know, government to support them to continuously provide these refresher trainings to the teachers, and also raise the bar for, you know, for entry, that the pre-entry for teachers. In my country, it's very disheartening. In Uganda, you find that only failures go to the teaching profession, right? And so you expect a failure to teach, you know, our children. And then we want them to produce different results, you know? I mean, what we put in is what we get out. So ideally, you don't expect teachers to be able to produce the best when they are not actually the best. And we've seen even the, you know, Prime Minister's office publishing results. They examined teachers in math and English, and 80% of them failed, you know, like they really failed. And the whole country was talking about this. And we were like, what is really going on? So we say that actually right now government is waking up, and they have at least raised the bar for pre-entry into teaching colleges to, you know, to at least credit. If you have a credit 3, a credit 4, that's when you'll be allowed to join the teaching profession. Yes, please.
Sharon,
yes.
You're just talking about the challenges of what's happening in Uganda, and yet you are promoting Teach for Uganda. How are you addressing these challenges?
Yes.
Because the same teachers you are targeting are the same teachers that the government is targeting. So what is Teach for Uganda doing differently?
Okay. So Teach for Uganda, we develop young leaders who expand educational opportunities to children. So we recruit, train, and place top recent graduates into underserved communities to teach math and English in order to improve the learning outcomes of children. And so that is done in a 2-year teaching as leadership fellowship. So how we do this is that the recruitment process alone is very, is everything. It is the, you know, it determines whether our program is going to succeed or not. And so we tend to look at the mindsets. We evaluate the mindsets of the fellows who apply, of the participants who apply into the program. And we ask them there are two questions actually that we always ask them. What is your motivation for wanting to join this fellowship? And where do you see yourself in the education space in the next 5 years? And then the second question is, do you believe that all children have the potential to succeed in school. And so the moment those two questions help us to gauge actually one, the mindset of the participants that who are applying into the fellowship, but two, we also get to gauge other things like communication skills and blah blah. So it's really competitive. And so at the end of the day, when we bring them into the fellowship, we train them for 6 weeks, and those 6 weeks we focus especially on the pedagogy, and that pedagogy is obviously gender responsive. And so we make sure that the way we train them in lesson planning, in, you know, classroom management, vision setting, you know, using data to constantly improve their teaching effectiveness is all geared towards helping them to become effective teachers. And once we place them into the classroom, we constantly coach them, you know, we do classroom observations and coach them, you know, in order for them to improve their teaching effectiveness, because we believe that just doing the pre-service for 6 weeks is not going to make them great teachers. So we continue to provide that in-service training plus the coaching, and that is when we actually get to see results in the classroom and seeing, you know, behavior change in the learners and also in our fellows.
Thank you. So coaching, accompanying, and just making sure they're doing the right things seem to be the trend in Teach for Uganda. What about in IRICS? What has been your experience in Kenya and also from the global perspective?
Sure. So I would say that just broadly in the teachers that we work with from around the world, that I mean, there are many barriers and challenges, and actually a lot of them have been said here today, but I think they fall into four buckets. So cultural challenges, economic, school environment, and also government policies. And in talking with teachers from all over the world, they're all saying very similar things. And I think many of those things have been mentioned here today. There's one in particular that I haven't heard that I wanted to mention, and that would fall under cultural challenges and the gender digital divide. I haven't heard anyone talk about that yet today, and so I just wanted to mention that we at IRICS did actually a political economy assessment in Myanmar, and so it was interesting. As part of that assessment was, it wasn't just about access to ICT, but about perceptions. And perceptions that were different between girls and boys in the use of technology and the value of technology. And there was a difference. So the girls actually were more likely than the boys to believe that ICT did not bring enough of a benefit to them to justify the time and the expense in using it. And so it's just I wanted to toss that out there. It's something that I haven't heard today. And if you all are interested, we have that, actually that report's on our website and you can check it out. Of course, there are many other challenges, cultural challenges that have been mentioned, the gender stereotypes and textbooks, early marriage and pregnancy, valuing boys over girls, etc., economic challenges, the cost of schooling, boys needing to be wage earners, girls staying at home from school, government challenges around policies related to curriculum development, school environment, long and unsafe commutes, lack of services for students for special needs, etc., etc. So the list is long and varied. And it's complex because it varies not only by country, but within countries. So when we talk with teachers from the same country, depending on the region that they're in, right, they face different challenges. And so it makes it this complex web that can be a challenge to break down, to figure out exactly what needs to happen in that particular situation.
Thank you. Excellent. Hawa. I want you to comment on the same, but maybe looking at it from a perspective of what are the incentives for teachers to take on new methodology. Do we see that happening in Uganda, for instance? And what could be things that will entice them to do that?
I think it's going to take some time, and I I will suggest two things. One, a supportive school administration, because the teachers work according to the rules and regulations of their school. So if this is a culture that is embraced by the administrators and reinforced, because that's how they're going to be paid, that's what they're going to be held accountable to. And maybe it could start slowly, maybe say make sure you have two sessions or three sessions. It doesn't have to be every single class, because change takes time. But if administrators can say, okay, this week, you know, how many with the lessons you had, you know, were you able to use, you know, gender-sensitive pedagogy in at least two of your lessons? Yes, and then have such discussions. And secondly, creating a community of practice for the teachers so that they have support. So if a teacher is being, you know, motivated and using the gender-sensitive pedagogies, they need people, you know, to talk to within when they're having these challenges, teachers that are going to have their back. And with what we've done, we've realized after several years of teacher training is that this is important. And at Educate, we've started inviting teachers from different schools to come together. So teachers come from different schools. They go observe a fellow teacher teach, and after that have a discussion. They have WhatsApp groups where they can continue, you know, sharing ideas. So if at training they were, you know, energized and happy, that's a forum to go and have such discussions. If they were sad about something, this is a forum where they're going to go and share it, and other teachers who are emulating the same thing, are able to support and encourage them. And we started that last year, and we've started seeing improvement and support. And we've also started getting these teachers. So instead of me going into the curriculum reforms and the policy discussions, I always go with the teachers. So they provide, you know, themselves, after being part of these discussions, they feel good. They go back and, you know, they are more energized to practice and, you know, to implement these methodologies, because now they realize that their voices do matter. And also, we've decided to have teacher leaders. So in instances where someone else from outside the school would come and train, now the teachers we've trained, their teachers themselves pick their teacher leaders. And these teacher leaders motivate them. These teacher leaders, you know, support them. They're the ones that, you know, do the trainings. So what we do, we bring the teachers together, but these teacher leaders lead the trainings, not us. And we started seeing progress, and we started seeing results. And before we started doing that, change was really, really hard.
Sure. And so does it matter whether the teacher is a female or male, knowing that in many of the countries, particularly including in Uganda, there are more male teachers?
I think it does and it doesn't. One, it does in a sense that students can have a role model, those that want to be teachers, someone they can adhere to be, and, you know, want to be as teachers as well. But at the same time, just because a teacher is female does not mean they are going to be gender sensitive. They might be the ones reinforcing the stereotypes themselves. So, and particularly in a country where we have more male teachers than female teachers, it is super important that we have men on board. And if they are gender sensitive, even if the curriculums are not, these are the same teachers that are going to make their classrooms gender sensitive, once they know how to do it.
Can I add? I also think that the fact that we have more male teachers than females, the more trainings we need to do around gender-sensitive pedagogy, because they teach our children every other day, and so the language they use in the classroom, the culture that they create within the classroom really matters, and we need to question whether it fosters, you know, inclusive learning or not. And so one of the things that I also feel that we should be doing is modeling for teachers. There's talking about gender-sensitive pedagogy, but teachers don't even know how that is done in practice. So if we can model for them what that looks like and continuously observe them, do it, and give them feedback to improve, then they'll be good at it over time. So I think more time is needed for retooling the teachers and also making sure that they get the much needed support.
Thank you. That's the gender matter.
So I actually agree with what you'd said. It matters and it doesn't matter. So I think we've seen male teachers become leaders and really strong advocates for gender inclusive teaching. We've seen it in Pakistan. We've seen it in Morocco. And I think in patriarchal societies, that can be a really key for change. But the one point I wanted to make is that female role models, of course, absolutely matter. But it's also important that the teaching force is representative of the society of around them and in this what the classroom looks like, right? So gender makeup is important, race is important, geography is important. The teaching force at the school should be representative of where the students are coming from and who they are.
Thank you. I know we are running short of time, but maybe we can move to the next segment of it, which is around policy opportunities. And I want to come back to you, Hawa. In your paper, you provide concrete examples or recommendations to the ministry around national strategy for girls' education, as well as school-level policies. What are the policy opportunities right now, and how do each of your work with governments create broader system?
Yeah, I think the time is prime. We are moving towards reviewing, the government is moving towards reviewing these policies, especially the National Strategy for Girls' Education, but also drafting the National Teacher Policy. And this is good timing to make sure that in the drafting, before these policies are passed, they are well written, they are realistic, and they can be implemented within the schools. But also particularly making sure that teachers are the ones, a part of these discussions, are shaping these voices. And because if they feel like, you know, because they're the ones who teach, but most of the discussions are separated from them. But if they are leading these discussions, making decisions, and providing insights on how they can actually be implemented in their schools and their classes, I think that will be a great opportunity.
Thank you.
Are there opportunities within policy opportunities in the way you approach it from Teach for Uganda?
Yes. So we, at the ministry there, we belong to a working group within the primary sector. So there's one for gender, there's one for primary, and then there's one for secondary. So during those committees, we actually are given opportunity to contribute towards the policies that that are being designed and implemented by the government. And so we have the opportunity to be able to make contributions towards them. And I think all of us as civil society, NGOs, should aspire to partner with government, because we can't really work in isolation. We need government. It's, it's a necessary evil. We cannot work without them, We need them. So we have to constantly find ways to work with them amicably to make sure that, that there's inclusive and quality education for all children.
Thank you. And Rebecca, at global level, do you see opportunities for policy?
Sure. I would add two things that I haven't heard yet, and that's, we've been talking a lot about in-service teachers, but thinking about pre-service teaching and the importance of working with pre-service providers and higher ed institutions and focusing on their ability to look internally at assessing and addressing issues around gender, inclusion, power, et cetera, because that's where I think we can get at some of the systemic change issues. And then the other point I would make that I think I heard somebody earlier today mention, but is really important, is about data and to be able to have data that can be sliced and diced different ways. To be able to disaggregate, so not just along gender lines, male, female, but to be able to look at that and see how a system is doing, say, for example, with girls who have disabilities, so that we're able to narrow in and address the specific issues that are happening in that context. I think that's another important issue as we look at policies at a national and global level.
Before we move to the question and answer, how are the... We've talked about government, we've talked about civil society as strategic partners in policy change. Any other partners that we should leverage besides the government and civil society?
Of course, the teachers. The schools, so definitely we as civil society, sometimes we try to work alone with the teachers and leave the government alone. And sometimes the government tries to work alone. But at the end of the day, we need to figure out how to close the loop and so that we are not isolated, where we have government, we have the schools, and we have the civil organizations, all of them working at the same time on the same thing.
Thank you.
Any addition?
Yes. The parents, too, are very critical. I always say that the first teachers we have are our own parents, and we are parents to our children. And so all those gender norms and stereotypes are formed at a very early age, you know, within the family unit. So if we can be able to dismantle that, I think we would have, like, killed the beast at birth. So, so I think we need to engage the parents a lot. In our work, and we also need to engage the colleges, teacher training colleges, because they actually train the teachers. So if we want the teachers to be gender responsive, then we need to make sure that what training, the kind of training they get from the colleges is actually suitable in terms of the implementation they'll be making on the ground.
Yeah, thank you so much. I know we are running out of time, but we want to give the opportunity to the audience to ask questions, comment, or give us your insights. Yes, I can see hands up. I'll start from the back. The gentleman who take four. Can you please raise up your hand this side? I think I saw four hands. So the gentleman at the back, and then second, third, and fourth. Thank you.
Thank you. Emo Sajani is my name. And you touch on the two questions that I have towards the end. I just want to pinpoint specifically. It's one thing to train people. It's another thing to have ability to achieve what you're training them to do. So from the teacher's production standpoint, are there any efforts that is being taken to actually look at the sources of where the students are coming from? Because, like we said, charity started at home. So that may be facing the source of the problem from the gate. Leveraging data will be very helpful to see good teachers, what type of society or what type of homes did they come from? Can we emulate there or model there? And secondly, was the parent aspect of it. Creating awareness with the parent, what type of work is being done in that space? Thank you.
Thank you. For the next speakers, please, just one question so that we can allow for more questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda Wafi from International Youth Foundation. I had a question about systems change. We talk a lot about sometimes incentivizing, providing incentives for parents to take and keep their children to school. In terms of incentivizing teachers to use and integrate the gender-sensitive pedagogy, is there anything that can be done to incentivize the schools and the administrations to adopt that type of curriculum or pedagogy? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very insightful session. My name is Oninye Ed, public health researcher and practitioner. My question is, I want to understand the role of, I don't know if it's a role, but sexual and gender-based violence, how do you incorporate it into gender-sensitive pedagogy? Because I really believe, I work on education issues, and in Nigeria specifically, sexual and gender-based violence really impacts educational outcomes, especially for girls. So I wonder how you infuse that, or if you don't, I'm just curious to know if that is incorporated in gender-sensitive pedagogy.
Thank you. I think we allow for those three. There's a question around, of course, gender-based violence, systemic change, and incentive for teachers, as well as the issue of looking at where the children are coming from. Can I ask each one of you to pick one? Who wants to go first? Yeah,
I'll take the one for where children come from. So part of what we do at Teach for Uganda is our fellows are required to do home visits. So for them to really understand the child holistically and be able to support them fully, they need to understand where the children come from. So they go and visit the homes of the children and talk to the parents about their aspirations for their children and how they can work together collaboratively to make sure that the children stay in school and succeed. So you find that by visiting the home of the child, you realize where this child is coming from, why probably they come late every day, why they don't have a book, or a pen, and why they're always looking shabby, at school. So when you make those visits, you're able to actually identify with them, and then you'll be able to realize that, oh, it's because of this that actually this child is like this, and this is how I'm going to support this child and help them to achieve. So really, it is very important that teachers build a very strong relationship with their students, because you cannot help children succeed unless you're friends with them, And two, engage the parents constantly to make sure that actually they are aware of what is going on in their child's life. And someone also asked a question around how do you tell where good teachers come from? I think we haven't really, I don't know if there's any research that has been made around identifying the backgrounds of great teachers, versus bad teachers. But I think it all stems from passion. If I actually enrolled as a teacher because I was passionate about children, I was passionate about education, you will be able to see something unique about me that is so different from other teachers. And we've seen this, because you'll find that teachers who go an extra mile are teachers who have actually chosen to be teachers, and they have really excelled in their studies. And so when they come into the profession, they do it out of love and because it's something that they chose. And I think that is one thing that probably motivates them to keep going.
Ella? Yeah, I'll talk about the teacher incentive. It has been a question we've been grappling with for so many years. And we've put strategies into place to have a supportive administration, a community of practice for teachers. But also with that, teachers still have some challenges around payment. They still have challenges back home where they come from. And my role at Educate enables me to be part of discussions. And with UNICEF and other organizations, we've been discussing on the teacher incentive framework for Uganda, looking at what will incentivize teachers not only to use gender-sensitive pedagogy, but also to use learner-centered approaches as a whole. And we've come up with several things. We've involved the teachers. And I think 2 months back, a teacher incentive framework was launched, but also it led to a discussion of increasing teachers' salaries, which could happen anytime soon. It was approved by the government. However, I won't say that this will be a solution or it will see the change, because this is the first time the government is increasing salaries for teachers. It might incentivize them, it might not. We don't know for sure. It will be a good thing to learn and study. And at the same time, for the National Teachers Policy, there has been a framework that has been established for teachers' dialogue to make sure they are part of the discussions at the national level and contributing and making sure that teachers are incentivized to do this.
Thank you. Do you, Rebecca, do you want to talk about violence?
I'm afraid that I am not an expert in that area, and it's such a complex topic that I would not want to speak about it. But I did want to touch on actually the comment about parents and the importance of the engagement between teachers and parents. I think that that can make a huge impact in a community. And so one of the themes that I've heard today that all of the panels have talked about is identifying the leaders in the communities who can really make an impact and a difference. And I firmly believe that teachers are, in fact, many times, teachers are, in fact, leaders in their communities, and they make that difference. And so, for example, I know of a teacher in Pakistan who lives in a more rural area, and he felt like that, you know, not enough girls were attending schools, and so he developed a program that reached out to parents in the community to educate both mothers and fathers about the importance of girls. And as a result of his actions, there was an increase in enrollment rates of girls in that community. So I think there are we have lots of examples like that that really demonstrate how important it is for teachers as leaders in their communities.
Thank you. Howard, do you want to comment on how are you handling the issue of gender-based violence in schools within Educate?
So within our curriculum and what we do with our teachers, gender violence can be both physical but also mental. And how you teach students, you can either violate them or not. So if a teacher is abusing me, that's violence. So we work with teachers and support them to not use such languages and for them to be very careful with what they do with their students. And in the past, after the trainings, teachers will go and do their lesson plans by themselves. But then we've seen that didn't work, and we moved forward to making sure that beginning, before the term starts, the teachers come together in a group and they write their lesson plans, how they are going to teach different sessions, which words they're using, how are they, you know, including all both boys and girls, and how are they making sure they're not violating. And some of the teachers also will come up with things they say that they didn't think were violating students. And then they're like, okay, so how can we address them? And as teachers, they come up with their own solutions. That's how we've tried to address that within Educate.
Thank you. Teach for Uganda, very briefly, because I want to give opportunity to a few more questions.
Yes, so because we place fellows directly in the classroom, definitely we constantly grapple with the issue of violence against children, and it's something that we are very strong about, and we emphasize in our training and making sure that that we enforce, you know, positive discipline in the classroom. And so we also go an extra mile to get our fellows to sign child protection policies that will bar them from, you know, enforcing any form of violence against children. And so one of the things that we talk about when we are talking about creating a very positive classroom environment is that you need to come up with rules, you know, or consequences that are age-related, you know, they are age-related, right? And they are positive, and they maintain the dignity of the child. So if anything doesn't, if any rule or punishment that you come up with is outside of that, then you should never enforce it in the classroom. So really, that's how we've been able to ensure that there's free, you know, our classrooms are free of violence, and also there are organizations like Save the Children and others that have done a lot of work in terms of, you know, sensitizing the schools, the teachers, and the students, you know, against violence to children. So really, there's so much that we have learned from them and adopted in our context.
One last thing. I think also we've worked with the schools themselves to come up with their own gender code of conduct. And they come up with the things they are going to be doing and not doing. And then they put that in the teacher staff rooms and also posters in schools so that teachers get to see that every single day and the students as well.
Thank you. I know you've been talking about the gap between policy and implementation. So I hope that has also been taken into account even when they do the code of conduct and so on. But let's move to the next lot of questions. I'll go this side. Four questions. Yes,
my name is Urvashi Sani, and I live and work in India. Also a former Echidna scholar, and thank you for the panel. I just had a, you know, you were mentioning that people think of gender-responsive pedagogy differently. And we look at it as, and we call it a critical feminist pedagogy, both for girls and for boys. And what we mean by that is that we teach, we train, but somebody said training is a bad word just recently, someone told me, so we educate our teachers to look at it, to look at their own gendered lives, to look at patriarchal structures, power structures, and then to work with students to question them alongside. So it's we're not looking at it only as a gender-sensitive pedagogy, but as a critical feminist pedagogy. And I was just wondering that is that the way you look at gender-sensitive pedagogy in the same way that, or is there a difference? I'm just curious. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Cameron. I'm a PhD student at University of Maryland. Really, I'd just kind of like to piggyback off of what you've just said. I think you put it so eloquently. Thank you for the panel as well. I'm curious, to what degree are you empowering teachers to be the change agents, right? So more so than just being aware of kind of gendered violence, so to speak, right? Maybe physical, but more so mental, as you've mentioned, but to really be critical and challenging of the social norms. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Joyce Kinyanjui from Kenya, and thank you for a good presentation. I think as I'm thinking about the issue of gender responsive pedagogy, I can't help to think about the child, because everything we do is about the child. And there's this child, 10-year-old or 11 or whatever, she's in class and the teachers are amazing, affirming her and all that. And for lack of a better word, there's no gender-responsive parenting or gender-responsive socialization in the community. So this girl goes home, and the parents, you know, are not aware of these things, and the socialization in the community is very different from what she experiences in class. So my question to the team is, how do you work, because I've just been hearing the teachers, the parents, everyone else is involved, but how do you help the girl to understand the disconnect between her class, her family, and community?
One last question.
Hi, I'm Kim from the Millennium Challenge Corporation, and I feel like we've been kind of talking around behavior change today. So I was just wondering if you could speak specifically to the behaviors that you're targeting in teachers and administrators, and whether you're integrating that into your projects.
Thank you. I think we are running short of time, so I would want you to pick one or two and use that as part of your concluding remarks. Who would like to go first? There's the issue of what is our understanding on gender-responsive pedagogy based on the experience that has been given. Are we empowering? Are we making teachers as change makers, or are we just creating awareness? And then how are we helping girls to understand the issue?
I'll take the one of empowering teachers. I think we're not simply talking about making teachers aware of, you know, of the gender-sensitive pedagogy, but we are actually, you know, empowering them to be, you know, gender-responsive so that they can actually be able to implement pedagogy that addresses all, you know, all these gender biases that we are talking about. And so even in the way they're teaching, the learning aids they're using, the examples they're giving, are they really showing that girls can actually be doctors equally as boys? You know, are they saying that I can, you know, a girl can also aspire to be an architecture and go ahead and become that? So when they give the examples, are they actually giving those examples that are promoting gender, you know, equality, as opposed to, you know, being biased about it? So it also goes back to, you know, the language that they use in the classroom, right? If I am a teacher and I'm constantly telling my students that, you know, if they are girls, and we know that from my culture, especially in Uganda, the girls from the rural areas are very shy. They do not speak up. They don't take up leadership positions. But as a teacher, am I aware of that? And do I actually go out of my way to empower these girls and allocate them leadership roles in the classroom to empower them to be able to find their own voices? You know, am I really doing that? Am I actually challenging them to dream bigger than, you know, their immediate surroundings, to become bigger than themselves, so that they can be able to achieve so much more, you know? And so those are things that we are talking about, and that's a kind of empowerment that we are trying to emphasize with our teachers, so that they can be able to see, you know, that from that lens and be able to empower our girls to equally compete in the same environment.
I'll talk about the students and the communities. I know I've talked about teachers because that's what my research was based on. But on my day-to-day, we work with students to empower them. And students get to have discussions around their cultural norms, their biases. They'll have discussions like when it comes to entrepreneurship, what's the role of men and women? And both boys and girls are going to have this discussion and have debates. They will discuss the roles of girls and boys back home and what that means for them and what that means for their future. They always have these discussions, but that's the first level. You empower them to have these discussions and to think differently. The second level is the communities where they come from. And we started leveraging the teacher-parents meetings. So when they have these meetings, we make sure that parents and teachers are having these discussions, at least having a topic in those meetings for at least 1 hour, where they're discussing how these gender norms are happening, the biases, and what the parents' roles are, and, you know, having some commitment and seeing how best to support their students, both boys and girls. And it is very important that the children themselves are part of the discussions, and their communities where they are coming from are also being enlightened and are ready to support them when they go back home.
Do you want to comment on the teachers, the students, and?
Sure. I wanted to highlight something actually that was said earlier around growth mindset and professional learning communities. So one specific technique that we use when we work with our teachers is teaching them about this concept of growth mindset, right, versus a fixed mindset. So the growth mindset, right, is the idea that you as an individual through intelligence, skills, et cetera, right, you can raise your expectations and you can excel and you can meet that, versus a fixed mindset, which is that you either have it or you don't. And so this concept that we use when we work with our teachers of the growth mindset, right, helps raise the expectations that they have of their students, so that as a direct result, then we see then the students' expectations are also raised. We've done work on this in the Republic of Georgia with the Ministry of Education and Science, and working, and this has been key in our work in developing professional learning communities with teachers or across the Republic of Georgia, and we have found that specific technique to be very valuable.
Yeah, I'm afraid we are running out of time, but maybe as part of my concluding remarks is just to bring in the dimension from Forum for Africa and Women Educationalists, just to highlight the key important things. When we are talking of gender-responsive pedagogy, we don't just look at the teachers themselves, we look at the school administration as well, because then they need to provide an environment to facilitate that change process. We also look at the students themselves to actually appreciate and understand, one, understand themselves, and second, understand where the teachers or the community and as well as their parents are coming from, so that when this transformation is taking place, it's not just targeting the teachers, but it's holistic in a way that it's looking at what policies are being put in place within the school to support that. It is looking at what engagement is going on within the community, so that when the change is happening, they also appreciate and support that. It's also about looking at the policy, making sure that we are working within the policy framework that is supportive. And if it's not, you have to find a way to actually bring them on board. Otherwise, we do one thing, the other parts are not working, it will never work. So gender-responsive pedagogy is possible. We need to work together to make that happen. Please allow me to say, to congratulate the panelists and yourselves for the interactive session that we have had. Thank you so much. I really appreciate, and I'm sure we've learned something from that.